With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning and welcome to the AgNet News Hour. Thank you for joining us. Coming up later, the EPA makes revisions to herbicide strategies. We'll have more on that, but our top story today, lawmakers in both the House and the Senate focused on the Biden administration's trade agenda for 2024 this week. Michael Clements tells us farmers and ranchers would like to see a more aggressive approach to opening up markets to American agriculture.
The Senate Finance Committee and House Ways and Means Committee held annual hearings this week regarding the president's trade agenda. Dave Salmonson, American Farm Bureau Federation Senior Government Affairs Director, says it's an opportunity for the administration and Congress to collaborate.
This is a required report in which the administration lays out what their accomplishments have been and what they plan on doing in the upcoming year. And this year, you had the U.S. Trade Representative, Ambassador Katherine Tai, came before the committees and laid out their ideas on trade for the year. So it provides an opportunity for some real interaction between the administration and the Congress on trade and the trade agenda going forward.
Salmonson says there was bipartisan concern that the administration isn't doing enough to improve trade.
A lot of discussion was about the fact that this administration does not pursue the traditional trade agreements. There was a lot of discussion about the fact that ag exports aren't keeping up with the volume and dollar value of ag imports, and also the lack of enforcement, especially in bringing trade cases with China. So there was an awful lot of, let us say, suggestions for improvement.
Salmonson says AFBF seeks more effort from the administration on trade.
We're not having the growth that we were used to having, going backwards some. We're not expanding our markets in a way that we want to. We need to diversify. More than half of our ag exports only go to 5 regions. We would like to sell more to a greater variety of countries, but unless we have an administration that's really willing to get in there and negotiate trade agreements and lower barriers that other countries have, we just really can't use that approach to grow our exports.
Learn more at FB.org. Michael Clements, Washington.
The National Agricultural Statistics Service recently announced it would no longer provide a July cattle inventory survey, as well as county-level estimates for crops and livestock, and objective yield survey for cotton. Several ag groups have responded, asking the NASS to reconsider. During a recent Senate Ag Appropriations Committee hearing, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack told the Kansas senator that Congress is to blame for discontinuation of the reports.
The problem, Senator, is that budgets have consequences, and when the NAS budget was reduced, there is a consequence. And more importantly, to this particular topic, when it takes 5 or 6 months for the budget to be passed, then the ability and the options available for dealing with a cut in the budget are limited. Limited in this case to the estimates that are future estimates, as opposed to estimates that have occurred in the previous 5 months of the fiscal year. So, would encourage adequate funding and encourage earlier decision making, with all due respect, because it makes it easier. And in addition, it's not just the NAS budget, it's also the fact that none of the pay increases were incorporated in the budget. So NAS and everyone else in USDA had to find the resources to deal with pay increases as well. So it's a
cost-saving measure in part, but it's also lack of information, timely information, to create the statistic that's needed.
Well, I understand, but...
No, I'm just reiterating what you told me to make sure I understand. That true?
That's correct.
Yeah. I certainly wouldn't defend the timeliness of Congress.
That would be hard to do.
It would be hard to do, and I wouldn't try it. I can assure you that the people that you've been visiting with this morning in this room share that view, that we ought to get our work done on time.
Having an understanding of the biology of mosquitoes will help in controlling them and minimizing their impacts. Rod Bain reports.
Spring is here, and now is a good time as any to learn more about the biology of mosquitoes so you could be prepared to deal with them.
A lot of people don't realize that there are important differences in what kind of still standing water different kinds of mosquitoes like.
You heard Penn State University Extension's Jamie Kopko say different types of mosquitoes. He points out regarding mosquito species in his state of Pennsylvania alone.
There are roughly 50 different species of mosquitoes.
Also mentioned different mosquito species perhaps use different types of standing water as their nesting area to lay eggs.
Some of them are all about a little pool of water that builds up in a clogged drain spout, or a discarded tire, or trash on the side of the road, or something like that. They love these teeny tiny little water bodies. And then you have other types of mosquitoes that are like, give me a swamp. I want a swamp or a pond or something big.
Another differentiation between mosquito species based on their biology, how far they can fly.
Some species, especially the ones that kind of go for those real small breeding areas, they tend to stay close to home. So they might never travel more than 100 or 200 yards their entire life. So if you can find where they're breeding and clean that up, you might make a big difference on how many mosquitoes you've got. Where other species of mosquitoes will fly for miles, and especially if like a storm system rolls through, the wind might blow them some. So you can be like, we're getting hit by all these mosquitoes all summer long and we can't find any breeding sites. Well, yeah, their breeding site might actually be a marshy area 2 miles upwind and they're all just blowing in.
And Copco says knowing when mosquitoes are active during a day part is important.
If the mosquitoes that are causing you grief are mostly active in the evening, if you can just coordinate your outdoor time to be like, we're done with whatever we're doing outside before the mosquitoes come out, that's a really easy way to just avoid them. Versus if they're out during the day, then your evening campfire might be totally fine and not get mosquito pressure.
Then there are potential mosquito treatment methods based on biology some homeowners can do on their own.
There are different traps on the market that you can buy that basically are just like a bucket of water, and you throw some grass clippings or leaf litter in it, and it creates this really appealing egg-laying site for them. And it's got a one-way door in it. So the female mosquitoes can get in, hoping that they're going to lay eggs, and then they can never get back out.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Chuck Zimmerman has today's National Spotlight.
Kevin, first of all, tell me your name and what you do.
Kevin Johansson, founder of Ag Butler. Ag Butler is a digital marketplace connecting farmers and ranchers with rural labor in our rural communities focused on agriculture.
Well, it's been a while since we've had a chance to talk, and kind of like an update because it's been a little while. Sounds like Ag Butler is doing pretty good. So what's new?
Yeah, I think when we last talked, it's been about 3 years. So we've grown exponentially over those last 3 years. We have a little bit under 3,000 users on the platform, and that represents 42 states across the country. Most of our focus is in on the crops and livestock side. And we've been focusing more on connecting laborers with farmers and ranchers. The platform is easy to use. You can sign up. You can get connected with farmers and ranchers in and around your area, but you can also search out for potential laborers that have experience in multiple industries throughout agriculture. And the way we have it set up, it's a user-driven platform to where anybody can see all the data that's run through there. We do not have it algorithm-driven like most mainstream job boards.
So I imagine this, a lot of this has to do with seasonality, right?
Yes. Starting out, it was set up as a part-time gig work, seasonal work. And when we started talking to more producers and agribusinesses, and they realized we were doing all of our promotion to the rural and ag communities, we started seeing more full-time positions being put on our platform for farm managers, herdsmen, and even agribusinesses in those rural communities looking for key team members to come on and help them thrive in those rural communities.
So tell me how this works. Like if you're, say, a worker looking for work, and is there a fee to use your service?
Right now, it is free to sign up and make a profile, and the only fee is directed to the employer. It's a simple $20 connection fee. As we look to grow this, we're looking to add in more tools that makes it more seamless and more efficient, and look towards more of a membership structure to where there's a lot of in-app communication, and you can pay your labor straight through the platform. We're not taking any percentage of that transaction. We're just there to make a marketplace to make it easier for people to connect.
Can they do this on a computer browser as well as maybe a mobile device?
when we developed the platform, we wanted to make sure we included everybody in agriculture. So we have apps in both the Android and Apple stores, as well as a web-based platform for some of the producers that do not utilize a smartphone.
What do you see at this point looking ahead? I mean, what's like the next step for you?
Like I mentioned before, is adding in those new tools and features to make a membership-based platform, but then also continue to grow and build the platform to where both employers and laborers can add more to their profiles to see what the job entails, but also laborers to promote what they're able to do with certifications, be it herbicide, pesticide application, on the livestock side, people that are BQA or PQA certified. That way, it is upfront that you can see those laborers are definitely qualified, as well as bringing in those new first-generational farmers, but also non-traditional ag students that are looking for more access to more experience and build out their own network. Ultimately, we'd like to get to a platform much like LinkedIn, but for the rural and ag community that is not only connecting labor opportunities, but also continued education and be a digital community.
So when it comes to farmer member organizations, do you collaborate with any of those? It seems like that might be a good thing they could add as a benefit to their members.
And we attribute our connections and partnerships with a lot of those ag groups, organizations, and associations like you mentioned. That's how we've been able to expand our coverage at such a quick rate. Working with those groups and providing information to those members on what we can supply them to, decrease that ag labor gap.
How about when it comes to investment? I know you've been doing this for a few years. Do you still seek that kind of assistance to grow and develop?
There's always going to be a need for capital because since we are a app and an online platform, we're always going to have to add more tools and features, keep up with all digital aspects that we need to do. And the biggest thing is promotion and education to our current users and our future users. So yes, we are always looking for additional investment in order to scale and facilitate everything in the country. We're definitely going to look to add more partners in investment to where we can continue to grow and make it more compatible with the evolving ag economy.
Before we close, just anything else that we didn't touch on that you'd want people to know about Ag Butler?
Well, Ag Butler was built with the farmers and ranchers in mind, and not only did we build it for ourselves because we are in ag day-to-day. We run a cattle and hay operation, and other family members run the crop operation in central Missouri. And so we did work with peers in the ag industry to make sure that the platform was compatible with their experience and it was easy to use for producers. And so we always want to work to make ag sustainable. Everybody talks about sustainable practices and protocols, but nobody addresses the real sustainable piece in agriculture, and that's the people. So Ag Butler wants to be that sustainable piece for people in agriculture.
Well, that is Kevin Johansson. And Kevin, great job that you're doing with Ag Butler. Thanks for the update. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
That's today's National Spotlight. This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will be back in just a moment.
Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is updating its draft herbicide strategy. The revision is meant to improve compliance with the Endangered Species Act obligations, aiming for flexibility and ease of implementation while safeguarding listed species. The strategy won't impose requirements but will inform mitigation for herbicide registrations becoming effective upon label adoption. EPA received feedback on the draft that had been released previously, prompting improvements focused on making the strategy easier to understand, providing flexibility for growers, and reducing mitigation needs based on voluntary practices and geography. Additionally, EPA is refining maps to ensure targeted mitigation areas, potentially reducing pesticide restrictions. Collaborating with stakeholders and agencies, EPA plans to finalize the strategy by August 30th. The nonprofit Seed Your Future has launched a 10 years, 10 days, 10K fundraiser to help support its mission of promoting careers in the green industry. The fundraiser marks Seed Your Future's 10-year anniversary and aims to raise $10,000 from April 22nd to May 1st. Money raised goes to supporting various educational programs and initiatives and further the organization's efforts in inspiring youth in horticulture, botany, agriculture, and environmental science. Seed Your Future's success is attributed to research-driven strategies and collaborations with other partners that have helped shape its outreach efforts. Initiatives like Bloom have expanded its impact by providing educational resources to millions of students, showcasing horticulture's relevance in daily life. To contribute or learn more, you can visit seedyourfuture.org. The Total Factor Productivity Index looks at how efficient agriculture is at transforming resources into commodities. USDA research economist Keith Fugley explains how the index is comprised.
It looks at what is the growth of this total output in real terms, so that fourfold increase. And then it looks at the total amount of land, labor, capital, as well as intermediate inputs like fertilizers and so forth. And it aggregates all that up. And it says, what's been that trend in total inputs? And if total outputs are growing faster than total input use, then we say that we've had an increase in total productivity. In other words, for a given set of those total resources, we're now getting more output from it. And that reflects better farming methods, application of new technologies, improved farming practices, also just more efficient use of producing the commodities that consumers want to consume.
Efforts to keep avian influenza from impacting California dairy cattle continue. CEO of Western United Dairies, Anya Radabaugh, said there's still more to understand about the ongoing outbreak.
The situation is evolving and changing, and I think it's very difficult as a farmer to have some patience while, you know, the bigwig scientists work their magic, but we don't know how it's spread yet. You know, like, what is the origin of this virus? We strongly suspect it comes from migrating birds, but is it the feed? Is it the bird feces? Is it the birds bathing in the water? These are all questions that have not been answered yet, and so guidance and directives will definitely be changing every single week as the scientists know more. For example, like, do we need to quarantine off our commodity barns? Because birds certainly enjoy their bird buffet in there, you know, eating all our delicious products, especially this time of year. It is literally a bird smorgasbord on every single one of our dairies. So the dairy farmers in California are actively harboring and protecting the tricolored blackbird, which is an endangered species. It is not a known carrier of highly pathogenic avian influenza. But Aleutian geese are, bald eagles are. And so this is why there's a lot of questions around the transmission. We know that once the herd catches it, it can go from cow to cow. And that's why we're trying to do what we can to separate the young stock, as it seems to only present itself in the lactating animals.
Applications are currently open for the Angus Foundation's Commercial Cattleman Scholarship. The program offers four $1,500 scholarships to outstanding young people in the beef industry. The scholarship is unique from others offered by the foundation, as it aims to support students specifically from the commercial sector of the industry. Students should be pursuing an undergraduate or vocational degree at an accredited higher education institution. Selection emphasis is placed on the applicant's knowledge of the cattle industry and their perspective on the Angus breed. Young men and women whose families use Angus genetics in their commercial operations are eligible to receive the scholarship if they have transferred a registered Angus animal into or out of their herd in the past 36 months. Students can apply until May 1st, and more information is available at angus.com/foundation. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Members of 4-H chapters from across the U.S. are gathered for their annual conference. Rod Bain has more in today's This Land of Ours report.
the 2024 National 4-H Conference held in Crystal City, Virginia.
To be able to come to Washington, D.C. for National 4-H Conference is really just an extraordinary experience for some of these young people who have never left their county. For many of them, it's the first time that they're getting on a plane.
Youth and 4-H National Coordinator for the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, Annie Cesarini, says almost 350 4-H members from U.S. states, territories, and tribal lands will participate in the six-day event. For the conference kickoff,
the Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, will talk to them during the Secretary's Assembly, which is the main event at conference. It kind of kicks off the entire event where they get to hear from the Secretary, and this year they'll get to ask him questions and do a fireside chat.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Canadians and their homes, along with farmland, timber stands, and other natural resources, are under threat of another severe wildfire season. Dennis Guy has more from Canada.
Continued drought conditions in the southern prairies and a fairly dry winter in some parts of central Canada have coupled with above normal temperatures forecast for the summer months. At a technical briefing held in Ottawa last week, ministerial department heads are warning that more dry weather is expected this spring and summer, making for greater risk of wildfire events. Low levels of snowpack and rainfall this past winter in some regions has made for an even higher susceptibility to wildfire again this year. More than 70 fires are already burning, mostly in northern British Columbia, northern Alberta, and in the Northwest Territories. Many of the existing fires have continued to smolder below ground throughout the winter months. Natural Resources Minister Jonathan Wilkinson says the high risk of wildfires in those regions is being closely monitored.
Early projections for 2024 indicate the potential for early and above normal fire activity over the spring months as a result of ongoing drought, warmer than normal temperatures, and drier than normal forecasts. The warmer than normal winter temperatures and drier than usual conditions may result in some regions, in particular Western Canada, Eastern Ontario, and Southern Quebec, experiencing early, above normal fire activity.
Currently, the worst drought conditions, ranked exceptional to extreme, are in southern Alberta, in central and northern British Columbia, and the southern part of the Northwest Territories. Canada experienced its warmest winter on record, with the three winter months of December, January, and February experiencing the highest average temperatures since Canada started keeping records back in 1948, according to Environment Canada meteorologists. Last year's wildfires put a strain on resources. In total, 5,500 firefighters from outside Canada were brought in to help with the fires. Natural Resources Minister Jonathan Wilkinson says the government has increased its firefighting budget and is currently training more than 600 new firefighters. Wilkinson also said that local and rural volunteer fire departments now have access to a federal program to help with training and the purchase of equipment.
The federal government is providing $256 million over 5 years to help equip provinces and territories. We now have 11 provinces and territories that have signed agreements, including long-term five-year agreements to access funding for this wildfire season.
Reporting from Canada, I'm Dennis Guy.
Well, you're reminded to do your training before using any existing stocks of dicamba products. Michael Clements has more.
Farmers need to remember that training is mandatory for everyone planning to use existing stocks of low-volatility dicamba products like Bayer's Extendamax herbicide with vapor grip technology, which has been classified as a restricted-use pesticide. Training helps farmers to achieve safe applications of these products and is essential to product stewardship that helps farmers maintain these useful tools. Jennifer Stutz, North American Weed Management and Chemistry Stewardship Manager for Bayer, talks about Bayer's efforts to get everyone trained for the season.
We launched a flexible, easy-to-use online dicamba training platform on roundupreadyextend.com/training. It offers a simple and efficient way for farmers to meet the EPA training requirement, no matter how many states they farm in.
The training covers everything a farmer needs to know about dicamba applications.
While Bayer experts present the training, it covers everything applicators and farmers need to know to apply existing stocks of low-volatility dicamba products by using Roundup Ready Extend technology, including the following products: Bayer's Extendamax herbicide with vapor grip technology, BASF's Ingenia herbicide, and Syngenta's Tavium plus vapor grip technology. Topics covered in the course include application timing, record keeping, sprayer cleanout, using volatility reducing adjuvants, determining buffer distances, application conditions specific to certain states, and dicamba restrictions. It also covers how to check for pesticide use limitation areas on the EPA Bulletin's Live 2 websites, how to help reduce the potential for drift, and best management practices for dicamba application.
Farmers can access the training online. Michael Clements reporting.
If you're planning on planting a tree this spring, an expert says don't try to baby that tree. Gary Crawford has this report.
Once again, we're coming to you live from, well, almost live in a way, from my front yard in Virginia, where I am about to do what I've always been accused of doing, and that is digging myself into a hole. But today, it's for purposes of planting a tree. Now, last time, you may have heard, I was out here scouting for a good place to plant it, and we had on speaker Kansas State University Extension horticultural expert Ward Upham. He's back with me now, I hope. Are you there?
Uh-huh.
Very good. Now, Ward told me last time to buy a tree from my local nursery because they would have the trees perfectly suited to my area. And he said to not plant that tree close to sidewalks or the house, to try to imagine ahead how big this tree is going to get and choose a location with that in mind.
They'll usually tell you on the tag, you know, what its final height's going to be and what its final width's going to be.
Oh, I forgot about that tag. I shouldn't leave that tag on there, right?
Often that's wire. And it's not going to hurt anything until that tree gets a little bit older. And when the size of those limbs or the size of that trunk gets big enough, that wire is going to actually kill it at that point. And so make sure you take those off.
Okay, that's done. Got it. And Ward, I've already followed your directions about digging the hole and making it three times wider than the diameter of the burlap root ball.
That gives those roots room to grow. Room to get out there in nice loose soil so it gets established quicker.
So I have set the tree down into the hole, cut away and removed the burlap root ball, and Ward, I've got some garden soil here I bought to fill in that hole. That ought to really make
it. Don't amend it. Don't add organic matter to the soil that came out of that hole. Go back into that hole with the same soil that came out of it.
Why? Why not some nice garden soil?
What happens is that water's going to go through that soil very quickly, and it's going to fill up like a pot does, and you could drown the tree. So go back in the hole with the same soil that came out.
But surely it needs some of this expensive fertilizer that I've got here.
Don't fertilize it. It doesn't make any difference that first year. What it's doing is expending some of its stored energy in order to get established. Fertilization that first year doesn't help.
Okay, whatever you say.
That's right.
That's right. All right. What about some mulch to go around that tree?
2 to 4 inches of mulch. Maybe pull it around away from that trunk just a little bit, and you're good to go.
Keep the tree watered so the soil is moist but not waterlogged.
That way you're going to get that tree off to a good start.
Okay, then. Thank you, Ward Upham. You know, I'll call you in 1 year and let you know how the little baby tree's doing.
No problem.
Okay, from my front yard, this is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet News Hour, and we will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. Every April 22nd is Earth Day, and this is Earth Week. Throughout Earth Week, President Biden's cabinet and senior administration officials are crisscrossing the country to highlight how the Biden-Harris administration is taking climate action. It included a kickoff call with selected members of the media. Speaking first on that call, Chair of the White House Council on Environmental Quality, Brenda Mallory.
Earlier today, we launched conservation.gov, a new resource hub to help connect people with information, tools, resources, and opportunities to support land and water conservation in communities across the country. This includes finding places to recreate outdoors, to volunteer on public lands, and a financial assistance tool to access grant opportunities. As you know, President Biden established our first national conservation goal to protect, conserve, and restore at least 30% of U.S. lands and waters by 2030. We are on track to meet that goal. As of today, President Biden has conserved more than 41 million acres of lands and waters in just over 3 years. And he is on track to conserve more lands and waters than any president in history. Ahead of Earth Day, the Biden-Harris administration has taken a series of major steps forward on the president's historic land and water conservation agenda. Today, the Interior Department acted to protect more than 13 million acres in the western Arctic of Alaska. These special areas, including lands in and around Tushutpuk Lake and Colville River, are a rugged and wild landscape that provides undisturbed habitat for wildlife, including grizzly and polar bears, caribou, and hundreds of thousands of migratory birds. Importantly, the BLM also announced that it is inviting public input on whether to expand these protections or whether to protect additional special areas in the Western Arctic. The Bureau of Land Management released its final environmental review for the Ambler Road project, which would span 211 miles of significant wildlife habitat, pristine waters, and subsistence areas through the iconic Brooks Range in north central Alaska, including gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve. The agency's preferred approach is that the industrial roads not be approved because it would have significant and irrevocable impacts on land, water, and species, including caribou and other subsistence uses for Alaska Native communities. Also this week, we expanded four new wildlife refuges, which will allow for the voluntary conservation of over 1 million acres of wildlife habitat in New Mexico, North Carolina, and Texas. And yesterday, Interior finalized a landmark public lands rule to help guide the balanced management of nearly 250 million acres of America's public lands, putting conservation and restoration on equal footing with other uses.
Also on the call was White House National Climate Advisor Ali Zaidi.
On Monday, the president will travel to Prince William Forest Park in Triangle, Virginia, a national park system site that was developed by FDR's Civilian Climate Corps. In the midst of a depression, President Roosevelt called on the American people to come together to take on the challenge and unlock the opportunity that sat inside of that, the opportunity to heal, the opportunity to lift folks up and to move America forward. The president, President Biden, will visit that site and talk about how the United States, in the face of a climate crisis fully manifest to the American people in communities all across the country, is also an opportunity for us to come together, to unlock economic opportunity, to create pathways to middle-class supporting careers, to save people money and improve their quality of life. As part of that, two of the signature announcements from that he will make on Monday, the first will be about expanding the accessibility of clean energy, especially to low and moderate income Americans. We've seen over the last several years, thanks to President Biden's clean energy agenda, the payback periods on home improvements, rooftop retrofits, appliances that save folks money, those payback periods have been reduced. The accessibility of these technologies has been increased. And as a result, the American people are saving money. The Solar for All program, which Deputy Administrator McCabe will speak to, is really, I think, emblematic of this swing for the fences, big, bold climate action that the president has championed from day one, not just solar for some folks, but really making sure that we're opening up a market where everybody, no matter their zip code or their economic background, can tap into the savings opportunity that clean energy represents. So with that announcement, one that will help 900,000 households tap into solar on roofs and in community gardens, I think we'll be able to speak to the incredible possibilities. In addition to the announcement on Solar for All, the president will be taking steps to advance the American Climate Corps, which he has launched through his executive authorities. The groundbreaking corps represents, yet again, a way to make accessible the economic opportunity and upside that comes with tackling the climate crisis. So for young people of all backgrounds, no matter their qualification, no matter their zip code, there will now be pathways and positions that they can fill that help them gain the skills to succeed in the clean energy economy.
You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. We continue with the environmental announcements from the Biden administration. I was on a call with selected reporters on Friday to get the information out first thing this morning. We continue now with the Environmental Protection Agency Deputy Administrator Janet McCabe.
When President Biden took office, he promised to create an economy and build a future that benefits all Americans. He and the vice president were relentless in their pursuit of historic legislation to help clean up our air and water, strengthen our economy, create good-paying American jobs, and deliver life-changing investments to communities across the country. Thanks to their leadership, the Congress passed the Historic Inflation Reduction Act, granting EPA more than $41 billion to help carry out this administration's ambitious goals. One of the most innovative provisions of the Inflation Reduction Act was the creation of the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, which was designed to mobilize private capital to address the climate crisis, ensure our country's economic competitiveness, and deliver lower energy costs and economic revitalization to communities that have historically been left behind. Today, I am so pleased to announce that EPA has chosen 60 applicants to receive $7 billion in grant awards through the Solar for All grant competition, enabling nearly 1 million households in low-income and disadvantaged communities to deploy and benefit from distributed solar energy. The grant competition, which is funded by the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, will provide funds to states, territories, tribal governments, municipalities, and nonprofits across the country to develop long-lasting solar programs that are targeted towards the communities and people who need them most. Some specifics: EPA received 150 applications, and applicants were selected through a robust multi-stage review that included input from hundreds of experts in climate, power markets, environmental justice, labor, and consumer protection from across the federal government. The 60 selected applicants include 49 state-level awards totaling approximately $5.5 billion. Six awards totaling over $500 million were selected to ensure that investments in solar energy are reaching Indian country. And we're announcing five multi-state awards totaling approximately $1 billion. The multi-state awards will reach people across the nation and invest in overburdened communities that the private market finds particularly challenging to serve. They focus on low-income communities, communities around historically Black colleges and universities, Hispanic-serving institutions, and tribal colleges and universities. Households served by rural and municipal electric co-ops, families in the industrial heartland, and low-income customers who are unable to build rooftop solar but could still benefit from community solar. This historic investment will generate more than $8 billion in savings on electric bills for the overburdened households over the entire life of the program. And many of the 60 selected Solar for All applicants have already begun supporting low-income and underserved communities through innovative programs that are already bringing clean, affordable solar energy to homes in low-income communities. With this new funding, Solar for All selected applicants can launch thousands more projects like these throughout every state and territory across the country. And let me give you a couple of examples. Delmyra Jennings and her husband, John, live in Athens, Georgia. With the help of selected applicant Capital Good Funds Georgia Bright Leasing Program, they were able to install a 13-kilowatt solar and a 10-kilowatt-hour battery system in their home last February, which provided them with backup power for 2 days after a major storm last year. Also, through the Solar Access for Nationwide Affordable Housing Program, selected applicant Grid Alternatives team in San Diego installed a solar energy system at an organization called Trolley Trestle, a group home for youth transitioning out of the foster care system. The new solar energy system will result in savings estimated at over $600,000 over 10 years, and that funding will be able to be reinvested to provide additional services to those who call Trolley Trestle home, including more job and life skills training.
The announcements continue the administration's focus on climate and conservation. That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.